The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And a couple of months ago, Michigan MUFON sponsored the greatly anticipated Swamp Gas UFO Conference in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which, by the way, was a huge success. And among the several top-notch speakers in attendance was researcher and author Peter Robbins. Peter addressed the ridicule factor that has been associated with UFO phenomenon at least since 1947. And Peter Robbins is an investigative writer specializing in the subject of UFOs. And he has more than 35 years' experience as a writer, researcher, investigator, lecturer, and author. He is a regular fixture on radio shows in the U.S. and in the U.K. and has appeared as a guest on and been consultant to numerous TV programs and documentaries. He has been a guest on this show before as well. Peter is a co-author, along with Larry Warren, of the best-selling book Left at Eastgate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident and its cover-up and investigation. And we are always honored to have him as a return guest, so welcome back, Peter.
Thank you, Dave. It's great to be back.
Good to have you. We had a great time at that there conference, didn't we?
Well, we sure did. It was a terrific conference and very well run and organized. We also had a lot of fun, and I would have liked to have heard more of the talks, but sometimes when you're a speaker, it's not possible, especially if you know, the tables are not set up in the actual lecture hall. But everything I heard, I thought, was first rate, right. And it was wonderful to see all you guys again.
Well, it was wonderful to see you, too, and had the pleasure of driving you back to the airport.
Yes, indeed, and a Chinese lunch beforehand.
Yep, Chinese lunch, and we had a little discussion about your life. You're coming out with another book. You're talking about doing a book about your life.
Well, yes and no. It would cut back and forth between papers, essays, articles, columns that I've written over the years, with the interspersing chapters being, more personal observations, kind of in the order that I experienced them in this crazy field.
And, of course, you'll send me a copy when it's done.
Oh, yes, which reminds me, I am very much enjoying a book that I'm reading right now called A New Heaven, A New Earth by David E. Twitchell.
Ah, who's he? I mean...
Hey, you're talking about a friend of mine.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good news anyway. Mm. Yeah, I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Yes, indeed.
And it's not that big of a book, Peter.
I know. I'm about a third of the way through. I have not had a lot of reading for pleasure time since seeing you or before, but it's on the stack.
Very good. Okay. We'll excuse you for not having finished it.
Thank you.
So back to the conference. Oh, by the way, on that conference, if our listeners plan on going to Ann Arbor for that conference and missed it, Michigan MUFON will have DVDs on sale that you can get of the conference. Now, this is not a commercial because MUFON, of course, is a nonprofit organization, and any proceeds would go to that nonprofit organization. If you're interested, you can contact me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. You can get with MUFON, Michigan MUFON, at mimufon.org. M-I-MUFON, M-U-F-O-N, mimufon.org. And, you know, send them an email and say, hey, I would like a copy of that. What's going on? And it's, what, about 8 hours worth of, it's a two DVD set. So, you know, and they're charging, I think, like $15, 20 tops. But I think it's $15. So get a copy of that. And Peter Robbins is going to be on that as well.
You know, David, the talk that I did get to hear and enjoyed very much is by my old friend and colleague, Grant Cameron. Mm-hmm. A lot of your listeners know Grant because he's a very respected investigative writer and author in the field. But Grant really built his career in an area of scholarship that he, in a sense, still owns, which is a history of the presidents of the United States and the subject of UFOs, mm-hmm. and every place that they intersect. And nobody's done more on location, in archives, in presidential libraries, et cetera, research on this overall subject than Grant. But several years ago, he began to research, investigate, and really live more UFOs and consciousness, and began a new fascinating series of talks. I thought it was great that Michigan MUFON director and, of course, our friend Bill Konkoletsky, however, asked Grant to return to his original area of the presidents and UFOs, in great part because of the whole story behind the Swamp Gas UFO conference, the fact that it is the 50th anniversary of the great J. Allen Hynek, when he was still a spook and a disinformation person working mm-hmm. for the CIA, mm-hmm. as well as the respected director of the astronomy department at Northwestern University, that he tried to explain away the Michigan 1966 sightings as swamp gas, a term that only he knows where it came from. Mm-hmm. And it's total ludicrousness on top of a history of attacking the subject and making fun of it really was a bit top-heavy, and so mm-hmm. I thought it was just great that the conference was actually named the Swamp Gas UFO Conference.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very good idea.
And even
yes, a wonderful talk, and certainly one that I think anybody would be interested in hearing.
Yeah. And even Hynek himself realized after the fact that the swamp gas explanation was a ludicrous one. And never lived it. In fact, he laughed at himself the rest of his
life. Not his greatest moment.
No. And it's like, you know, whoops, okay, I fell down in the mud. Okay, I'm covered. So let's laugh at me. I might as well. I can laugh. I can cry. So at any rate. Okay, so you showed, while you were there, you showed several cartoons that appeared in newspapers and magazines over the years. Now, I know we can't show them on the radio. You can hold them up to the receiver, but it's not going to work. So can you describe?
Yes, they were part of the presentation on the origins of so-called UFO ridicule factor, at least from my point of view. And the political cartoons I showed were all shown in the New York Times in the early 1950s. Mm-hmm. In one, you see a UFO and, you know, a citizen observing it through binoculars, and it's the high cost of living, get it, ha-ha. Mm-hmm. In another, believe it or not, the UFO, they show UFOs in a kind of a tableau over the Middle East as people are killing each other in the Middle East. Nothing new there.
Well.
And the one that is kind of poignant in a way, it's three little aliens. I'm sure if they were in color, they'd be green. And they are sitting in a cup inside of a saucer, as any good saucer should be used, zooming through space. And in the distance, receding, is the Earth. And the caption is one telling the other two, I did, too, see a blue-green ball.
Meaning the Earth. Yeah.
So it's all relative.
Yeah. Where does this, speaking of green men, where does this green men, little green men from Mars, where'd that come from, anyway?
I don't know. I have actually asked myself the question. It's come up occasionally because the catchphrase, you know, little green men and flying saucers is the ultimate put-down of anybody who has an interest in the subject. And it may have come from science fiction, you know. It may have been something that somebody mentioned and just sounded as loopy as flying saucers. So let's use that, too. I understand that they are not green, but I can't confirm that personally.
Right. Now, most abductees are people who have claimed to have had close contact with alien beings. Say they're gray. Most of them are gray. And some of them look just like us, or I think, more accurately put, we look just like them.
But
I had heard also, and I don't know how true it is, but I had heard that some reporter coined that phrase, little green men from Mars, and it kind of stuck, like you say, because it sounds as ludicrous as the idea back then of UFOs, or flying saucers, so to speak, was ludicrous, but now today, we don't really know, do we?
No, and you've reminded me that the most famous little green man from Mars is the Warner Brothers character Marvin the Martian.
Right.
And I'm thinking now that character has been around probably since the 60s, and if we can confirm that it was a reporter or a news person that coined that term, nothing would surprise me less.
Yeah, right. Any other cartoons that you can think of that you can describe that you showed on a
I think there was, oh yes, there was one other one for me, the most poignant in a way. It shows Uncle Sam with a shotgun. And this again is a 1952 cartoon, so the phenomena had already been around for almost 6 years, and he is shooting at a saucer, a skeet, disc, whatever, you know, and in the vapor trail of the disc is this very arcane kind of dated phrase, the limitless flights of fancy, i.e. imagination.
Right.
And there's a sign that you can just make out on the skeet range, something to the effect of really difficult to shoot down. And you see Uncle Sam is standing kind of ankle deep in shotgun shells, not doing a very good job of dissipating the subject.
Right, right.
Hmm.
And this was 1952. Speaking of 1952, how did the media explain the 1952 Washington, D.C. flyover of UFOs?
Well,
we have pictures.
I focused it on the New York Times because it really was the most influential news organization of its time and affected coverage in a lot of the other nationals. They looked to see what the Times was going to do. And they began their coverage flat out with ridicule, condescension, sarcasm. But basically what they did was they kept throwing these pseudo-scientific explanations at readers or in some cases, allegorically patting them on the head and saying, whatever it is, it's really nothing to worry about. You know, the Air Force is on the case, the fact that the Washington overflights It took several hours to get the first jets off the ground. Some of it is absolutely jaw-dropping in terms of excuses that the message that there were UFOs over Washington was relayed to a listening station in Pennsylvania, and that, you know, it got lost for several hours or something, when thousands and thousands of people are observing these things over mm-hmm. the Capitol.
Plus
reflections from clouds from the ground, mass psychology, jitters about the Soviets, hallucinations, actual dust on the eyeball. It gets pretty loopy.
Dust on the eyeball.
Yeah, there's a whole series of articles that the Times put forward earlier on that absurd explanation, and they repeatedly trot out authorities, people of stature in the field of astronomy, psychology, natural sciences, but have a habit in the early days of never naming the individual. Never.
Right.
I mean, it's shameless. It's really shameless. But it was such an assault that the American people bought it. It did fairly quickly.
So people had dusty eyeballs, and that's what...
That was one possibility, and you can see the guy rubbing his chin and frowning his brow.
Wasn't there also a thing about the blood vessel in the eye, some...
Pressure inside the eyeball.
Pressure inside the eyeball.
Soviet secret weapons, American rocket tests. You name it, literally. Again, low clouds.
Temperature inversion.
With headlights bouncing off of them. Hailstones that flatten out.
Mm-hmm.
That phrase is very difficult to forget, and we've all, of course, experienced flattened out hailstones.
Yeah, I have that written down here. Hailstones that flattened out and glided.
Yeah.
Now, that would
like
have
to be... Like
flying
squirrels, you know.
Yeah. That would have to be some huge hailstones.
A very interesting temperature situation that allowed them
to flatten.
As ice to not turn to water, but to flatten out and then get hard again.
Now that's,
hey, what do I know?
That would be a phenomenon in and of itself, wouldn't it?
Big time.
Yeah, big time. Okay. So there.
You have to laugh at this stuff, but it is insulting to the point of enraging.
Yeah.
Well, when you see it all lined up as you guys did when I gave the presentation.
Right. Well, that's what your presentation was all about, was ridicule and laughing at, the media laughing at people who accepted the fact that there were vehicles that are flying in our skies that defy laws of physics and aerodynamics. Ha ha. Well, now, so many years, 60-some years later, we can turn around and laugh at them. Because,
the big question I entered asking was how and when did this really begin? Because it's gone through most of our minds, anybody seriously interested in the subject, the deeper they get interested, you've got to wonder. It's totally counter common sense or intuitive. If the example I gave is if I ran into you on the street and we didn't live in a world where there were UFOs, it simply had never occurred, had all that conventional stuff.
Yeah.
And I said, I saw the strangest thing in the sky this morning or last night or whatever, and it or they did this, they were in this shape, they behaved in this manner, I've never seen anything like it, what do you think? And I think in a sane world, you would say to yourself, I don't know what to think, but that is interesting. I wonder what it was, too.
Yeah, I don't think as many people back then would say, oh, you must be crazy. You must be seeing something. You must be dreaming.
No, we were conditioned into it.
Right, we were.
Brilliantly done.
Right.
And pounding away. It continued for years. I mean, to a degree, vestigially, it still does. But at the same time, it was over by the end of July 1947. It continued, but the mass media had bought it, and the American public overall had bought it, too, that whatever it is, it can be explained, and we'll trust the authorities to do so.
In retrospect, I don't think it was as insulting to the UFO witness as it was to the general public to insult their intelligence by, you know, if they would believe, you know, hailstones flattened out and glided, and all the rest, you know, temperature inversion.
Yeah.
Temperature inversion.
Again, they were careful, they being the Times in specific and the media in general, to, I don't recall an instance where they're saying it is this, but it could be this, it could be that, it could be this, it might be that.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever it is, you know, no reason to linger, folks. Keep moving. Nothing to see here.
Right. Well, I got to admit, as an investigator, you first have to rule out every prosaic explanation.
Without question.
Right.
That's the basic.
But when those are ruled out,
yes,
what's left is unknown.
And that's when the work really gets interesting.
Really?
Unfortunately, most Americans were, it was a simpler time. It was a simpler country. It all seemed so out of the realm of real possibility to so many people, and to so many others, something that they didn't even want to begin to contemplate, not unlike a respectable segment of the public today, I'm sure.
Right. I need to take one moment, to just remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, 89.3 FM on your radio, and WHFR.FM on your computer. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Mr. Peter Robbins, researcher and author and lecturer and all kinds of things. You get wear all kinds of hats, don't you, Peter? So we're talking about the ridicule factor in the UFO field. And you drew a connection in your lecture to the connection between the 1947 Roswell incident and the Cold War. And what exactly did you where exactly do you see the connection there?
Well, by a quirk of fate, and we don't know the exact day, in the end of June, the very beginning of July, that craft or craft went down outside of Roswell, New Mexico, and again, July of 47. We do know the day that the debris field was found. And the whole story emerged in July of 1947, which predated the true, I guess, unofficial beginning of our modern age of UFOs, the so-called Kenneth Arnold sightings in Washington State in the Cascade Mountain Range on June 24th, so about a week and a half or so before Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
In July of 1947, the prestigious publication Foreign Affairs, which is still a very important and influential publication, had an article by a then unknown, I think a graduate student in political science, called On Containment, and it expressed a theory of how we could avoid a hot war or a shooting war with the Soviet Union, who were now truly emerging as our next real enemy, now that, you know, Nazism and the Japanese Empire had been defeated.
Mm.
And it laid out the realities that we were going to have to face, and that the best that maybe we could do, because nobody wanted another war, especially not in war-weary 1947, was do our best to hold them to the borders they had expanded into by the end of World War II and taking over so much of, well, Central Europe, and that became what we called the Iron Curtain, and to hold them to that line, we could avoid a hot war or shooting war and have instead a Cold War. The phrase emerged there, and call it serendipitous, but the Cold War and the modern age of UFO sightings and all of the implications that it come with it began at the same moment in history, it's just interesting to make that footnote. Also, one can argue that Roswell and the very ending of World War II are tied together as well, because 23 months before the debris that was collected and the remains of the occupants were collected, they were brought to a hangar on the Roswell Army Air Field Base and then flown in a special plane to, I think it was 8th Army Headquarters in Texas. Well, in August of 1945, as opposed to July of 1947, a highly secured B-29, as I recall, left that hangar, which is still there. It's the only major building still left on the old base.
Really?
And flew to California, where a device was attached, and then flew on to Japan and dropped that atomic bomb on Hiroshima.
Right.
That journey began in Roswell, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of wonder, what was the connection there, huh?
Well, I think the connection is that in 1945, all of the, you know, testing, research, development of the atomic bomb, so much of it had taken place in New Mexico, some of it in New York City, Manhattan Project, other locations around the country.
Mm-hmm.
But New Mexico became the location of what by 1947 was the only nuclear strike force in the world, the 509th Bomb Wing,
right,
which was stationed at the Roswell Army Air Base, and hence the nuclear age, and Roswell are once again connected.
Mm-hmm. The connection was there, yeah. And also in Russia, I forget what year it was now, it was in the 50s, but not trying to get away from Roswell again, but there were UFOs coming from the Russian area, and we thought it was the Russians, and the Russians thought it was us,
yeah,
and almost caused World War III before these bogeys, unidentifieds, flew away.
Yeah, I expect that scenarios like that happened on and off throughout World War, throughout the post-war years, because there was every possibility that legitimate, truly anomalous UFOs could be misidentified as enemy aircraft, setting off a war or some kind of terrible conflagration.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that classified flights could sometimes be covered up if they were picked up as UFOs. So the subjects were played against each other for 45 years, and very well at times.
Was that around the time that Russia and the United States established a hotline between the two of them, even though we were Cold War enemies?
I think that was in the early 60s, and
kind of like, you know, if we see these again, I'm calling you. Is this you? You know what I'm saying?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that detail. When I was a kid, there was a very popular best-selling novel that was made into a very good film that kind of epitomized that Cold War moment, which was called Failsafe.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And I reread it about a month or so ago on a whim, and it holds up very well, and was written, I hadn't remembered it because I read it when I was so young, but the president, the character that is so well played in the very good film version by Henry Fonda, is definitely written to be Kennedy, and his opposite on the other side is Khrushchev. It's
mm-hmm.
not a character based, you know, he's called Khrushchev and it's him, and to visualize that whole story play out with John Kennedy rather than Henry Fonda was even a bit more sobering than the first time around, but we're off on a Cold War tangent.
Yeah. Yes. Well, they say that the Cold War is starting all over again, but you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So we better, you know, we see UFOs, we better call Russia and say, is that you?
Yeah. Not a bad idea.
Yeah. The U-2 spy plane, Gary Powers, said to that was another excuse they would use for UFOs. Well, you know, the U2 was up there, and people would see the U2 and think it was a UFO. That thing had massive wings. You know, it made noise.
They were very long wings for the proportion of the plane.
I know
it. Fairly thin.
I know it.
But yeah, it had wings. That's the main thing.
It had wings. Yeah. So, well, people bought that too, and I think that's insultive to the people who bought that explanation.
Mm.
I saw this round, disc-shaped, silent craft that was hovering and then shot off like a dart from a standstill, and you saw the U-2 spy plane. If they bought that, shame on you.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay. That's my two cents. The Twining memo, was that a leaked document? Was that?
No. The so-called Twining memo written by Nathan M. Twining, who at the time was a brigadier general, and we're talking September of 47, Twining went on to become, I believe, chief of the Air Force, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a highly respected military person.
Mm.
And a document that he wrote early on, again, September of 47, is hyper-specific in talking about the physical reality of real UFOs, shape, movement, trajectory, and his famous quote of the phenomenon reported as something real and not visionary or fictitious. That's an example of a document that you would not have expected to be quietly declassified and made available to people. As I recall, in the days before the Freedom of Information Act, I have no idea how it works now, but back then, classified documents, I think, were supposed to be reviewed every 3 years for a dozen years, and after four passes, it was considered, you know, not of crucial importance to the national defense or national security.
Mm.
It would quietly, with no fanfare, be declassified and deposited in the National Archives, where diligent researchers were coming upon them, going back before FOIAs could be done, and Freedom of Information Act began under President Carter. So, yeah, that is a legitimate, honorably written, declassified document that one would think, in a way, would have changed the world when it came out, you know.
Right, right.
But
and you know, he wasn't disciplined for making this statement that this UFOs were real and not something visionary.
Well, apparently just the opposite.
I mean,
he rose to the top of the military power structure in America.
So why was it, you know, what? What year was this, or era was this, the Twining memo?
Well, it was written in the, late September 1947.
Okay.
I don't know exactly when it was declassified, but it would have had to have been more than a dozen years later and likely longer than that.
Really? So why is it, why was it all right to admit to this phenomenon back then? And is not today?
Well, first of all, they're not talking to us in a document like that.
Well, they
they're
are
talking
they,
to each other.
If they
and
if
so
they
it is understood that there is the truth and the stuff that we can't tell the public because, you know, run all the normal excuses starting with fear of mass panic and blah, blah, blah. They have some gravitas to them, but it's nothing's changed in that respect.
Right, all right. But if they declassify it, aren't they speaking to us? Aren't they putting that out for us to see?
Well, that's a very good question. Again, these documents are not subject to commentary. If you were to go to the equivalent office, well, I guess the office that issued that doesn't exist anymore, so nobody would take responsibility for it, but say it was a CIA-generated document or FBI, like some of the very provocative ones involving Hoover around this subject, going back to 47. They wouldn't deny that it's a real document, but they'd have absolutely nothing to say about it. And
and
that's standard policy.
And their silence speaks volumes.
I guess.
Yeah, it would to me. So how did Truman handle the UFO problem back then?
Well, I think the best he could, and I say that not from the point of view of an historian, but somebody who made a point of reading his memoirs and letters and understanding as best I could his background, the wonderful documentary on him that shown, I guess, about a year ago on PBS. And he was an everyman who rose to be president of the United States, and, you know, he was the one in power when it hit the fan. And I think we can all agree that he pulled the best minds in the departments that made sense to him into a circle, and they looked into it, the people we now know as MJ-12, the original group. And I think if it had truly been up to him, and it's not something that could happen today, no president, no prime minister, no king or, you know, supreme ruler could really get away with doing this on their own. It would have to be coordinated with other world leaders, with probably religious leaders, business leaders, corporate leaders, financial experts. But
and then it comes to a matter of design by committee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that there was a window. There was a moment in 1947 when Truman could have stepped forward. Maybe that autumn or winter or whatever, a few months after assessing that we had a real situation here and laying it out for the American people and the world. One, I don't even think I can imagine how different the world would have evolved had he done that then. There's no way to prove this, but I think that those around him who were involved in this group or the secret keeping or ongoing discussions, as they say, counseled him against it, that they had to know more. I think that might have had to do with pride or vanity that they really didn't know.
They had to be in control.
Yeah. And that situation was never going to happen.
No.
And so, you know, we evolved into this national security state. We're at the center of our very culture is this deeply embedded lie that, you know, makes the world to a degree as schizophrenic as it is.
Really? I have to take one more moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM. Station Making Waves, 89.3 FM. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Mr. Peter Robbins about the about the UFO ridicule factor, actually. And we're talking about Truman, how he handled it, and he was going to keep quiet in 1947. But when these little beggars started flying over his house in Washington, he said, shoot them down if they don't answer their hail, right?
Yes, that order was given. Mm-hmm. And there is the most complete book imaginable on the subject called Shoot Them Down.
Right.
And it's by Frank Francesco.
I know.
Oh, God, he's a total sweetheart and a great job on the book.
He was on the show, too.
Ficino, I think.
Ficino. Yep. Frank Ficino.
And, wow, what a labor of research that is and what a treasure trove of information. But, yeah, that could have been I'm sure it was a nail-biter for anybody that was commanded to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or to attempt to.
Yeah, but there were attempts to shoot him down. And then they started defending themselves. We ended up losing a lot of Air Force pilots as a result.
It sure seems that way. Yeah. And he presents the best case, although a lot of it will always be circumstantial, but I've never seen it better presented and it's an awful lot of missing, dead, especially military pilots that need accounting.
Yeah. I can't remember. You'll probably know who I'm talking about, the guy that they said he was chasing Venus, the planet Venus, and got up too high and lost consciousness. And Mantell?
Oh, yes. Captain Thomas Mantell, who was the best, the pilot whose name we all know, who was killed in a scramble with a UFO. Whether or not he blacked out after he got above the oxygen limit that plane was built for is certainly possible. But the accounts in the media are, there are reports that the plane was struck, and then that's kind of mollified, but it is still an unsolved case, no question about it.
Yeah, yeah. And it would seem, correct me if I'm mistaken, but if you plummet in a plane from that height, there's not going to be a lot of that plane left.
Yeah.
Or the body. And yet there was. So a lot of things that haven't hasn't been answered yet. And a lot of things that contradict a lot of these facts that they put out, or alleged facts, that contradict each other. Okay? So this guy, Mantell, was a seasoned Air Force pilot.
World War II pilot. Who is now with the National Guard, as I recall.
Yeah.
And this occurred in Tennessee, I think.
Kentucky, yeah. Kentucky. And, what was I going to say then? The fact that he not only was a experienced pilot, but, they had a radar. They had this bogey on radar.
Oh, yes. It's certainly a well-confirmed case, no question about it, David.
I don't think they'd have the planet Venus on radar.
Yeah, right. That's another one. It's like saying that what those security police saw in the Rendlesham Forest in December of 1980 was the reflection of a lighthouse in the distance as opposed to landed craft on the ground is, please. My favorite line by the great television jurist Judge Judy, don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining.
Right.
I believe I can say the word pee on radio. If not,
you just
sorry
did.
About your career.
You just did. If not, we'll hear about it. And I will say, grow up. Anyway, back to the shoot them down. Yeah, we lost a lot of pilots because of that order. So they stopped that order.
Yeah.
So, do you think the government was in cahoots with the media to keep a lid on the UFOs back then? Thus the ridicule factor?
That's certainly one of the abiding questions. I've come to believe, based on an awful lot of research, a lot of critical thinking, and a lot of investigation, that they pointed the media in terms of, again, we're talking 1947 here. Television is really not an entity. Radio is certainly in its own, but newspapers are the driving news force, and I do think the chances are excellent that key people within the Truman administration met with and made a suggestion on editorial policy relative to this incredibly new subject that should have been such an exciting challenge to real reporters and journalists and editors all over the world to tackle this phenomenally interesting story. And instead, in a split second, it was turned into an international joke. And it worked very well. It worked very well.
Yeah. So, I don't think it was you, but one of the speakers at the conference, the Swampcast conference, said that, or speculated that there were rumors going around that CIA agents went into the media, radio, and magazine, The Times. And was that you that said, you know, speculated that they had said something to them? Let's make a joke of it or keep it quiet.
Well, CIA certainly codified and formalized all of what I'll call nonsense, what they called an education program, in a series of meetings that have been come to be called the Robertson Panel in early 1953. But what you're saying there is logical. There's no question that from its birth, the Central Intelligence Agency has had its tentacles into, you know, broadcast media, print media, publishing, as well as other intelligence organizations here and abroad. And I tend to think that the government didn't have to do a great deal, that we had a lot of useful idiots who did it on their own and who really embraced this kind of idiotic coverage and putting down anybody that, you know, thought that it was real on the public scene, like the great James McDonald, a physicist of the highest order who studied the atmosphere, was with the, very prestigious organization in Tucson, Institute for Atmospheric Physics, and who tried to go up against the establishment in the 60s and up into the early 70s and make UFOs a serious topic for consideration and study, and lost and went into a terrible depression, ended up taking his own life.
Did he take his own life?
Yes, but I think he was assisted in being driven into the state of depression, unquestionably, by people like Philip Klass and lesser-known debunkers who really did their best to destroy his reputation and ultimately did.
Yeah, I remember the movie The Godfather, where the guy who really told us FBI about the mobsters and what have you, and he's in protective custody.
Frankie,
And the lawyer goes to him and reminds him, you know, he's got a family out there, you know, do the right thing. Do the right thing. He ended up killing himself. So, do the right thing.
Well, I don't think that Dr. McDonald, he was on the other team. I think he just was worn down to that level of depression by that point in his life. His marriage had failed, as well as his career. A attempt to take his life had left him blind almost completely.
Right.
He couldn't get work.
But then there was Forrestal, speaking of suicides.
Well, that's a whole nother story.
Tell us that story. We have time.
I'd rather save that for a separate show. That is such a big story. And nothing I prepared for this one.
Ah, okay. Well, what did I miss here that you prepared for it and did not ask you?
I do have a new book out that I hope that people will read. It's something of a follow-up book to Left at East Gate.
Really?
That I wrote with Larry Warren, and also addresses aspects of the Rendlesham Forest story, and it's called Halt in Woodbridge, as in stop in Woodbridge, but Halt is the name of the deputy base commander of RAF Bentwaters at the time of the events. And he has gone out of his way for 30 years to try to discredit my co-author, and it all kind of came to a head last summer. And it compelled me to write a response to all of the things that he had said.
Yeah, I had you on the show, and we talked about that with Salas.
Yes, and just wanted to mention that is available, and if you have a Kindle.
Okay.
Otherwise, gearing up for a series of upcoming conferences, which I'm certainly looking forward to, although all of us speakers right now are waiting for a confirmation of the much-awaited Paradigm Symposium scheduled for May, for next month in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. Still waiting for confirmation on that. So you might want to visit the Paradigm Symposium website in a day or two and see if that conference is on.
Paradigm Symposium.
Mm-hmm. Website. Yeah, taking place in Minneapolis.
Who's putting this on?
Pardon me?
Who's putting this on?
It's a group called the. Well, it's run for several years, as I understand, called the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis. And other than that, though, I will be speaking in Cleveland. I'm looking happy to say in June and on. I think the 19th for MUFON of Ohio.
Aha. Cleveland is not that far from me in Michigan.
Yeah, and I will be speaking on the Rendlesham Forest incident, and I hope that some of our friends from Michigan MUFON will be able to join us there, and anybody else in that area who is able to visit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then my summer gets really exciting. I'll be reconnecting with my co-author, Larry Warren, and we will be speaking at the Scottish UFO and Paranormal Conference in Glasgow, Scotland, in late June of this year.
Our buddy Warren does not really like to come to the States, does he?
Well, it's not like that he doesn't like to. He doesn't have a lot of opportunity to, and, you know, travel's expensive. He's got a regular job and a 15-year-old son there, and that's the main anchor for him. He's a great dad.
Yeah. When I had the TV version of We Are Not Alone, I met Larry Warren in Laughlin, Nevada, when he was speaking.
Sure.
And he did a... an interview with me for that half-hour show.
Great.
And just the kind of guy I just want to sit down, have beer with, and chew the fat, you know?
Yeah, amazing guy for sure.
And honest as the day is long, I mean, he doesn't care. This is the way it is, and, you know, believe me, don't care, you know?
And yeah, he didn't become involved in this field to make friends.
No. He sure didn't, and I'm... From what I've witnessed of the case, he has not made friends.
Well, you know, he stands his ground. And I've spent a good part of my life backing up all of his allegations, memories, and claims. Mm-hmm. And he is the real deal.
Yeah. And I've got to hand it to you, Mr. Peter Robbins. Mm-hmm. You research in a manner that... If you have any doubt about things, let me speak to instead of blowing smoke up your skirts, I'm going to talk to my listeners. This guy, he researches in a way that if there's any question at all, he puts it off. He just puts it aside and talks about the facts and what he knows and what he can prove. And so that's what I've noticed about my friend Peter Robbins.
Thank you, David.
Yeah. So when you read something that's written by Peter Robbins, you know that it's been well researched. Can we be fooled in this this field? Of course. Yeah. But you don't believe everything that comes down the pike, neither do I. And you put it out there, people pick it up or they don't. That's the way it is. So.
Amen.
Yeah. So this halt in Woodbridge, the book you were talking about, not really a book, but more an article, last time you were on the show, that wasn't called Halt in Woodbridge, was it? It was something about deception?
Oh, that's a totally separate book.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
Was that a
came
book?
Out last summer.
Yeah.
It's called Deliberate Deception.
Deliberate
and
Deception.
And anybody that wants can get a free copy of it
mm-hmm.
by going to the website of Phenomena Magazine. Mm-hmm. Great publication. It's a monthly. It comes out of Manchester, England. Phenomena Magazine. Go to their website. You will find a box that says Special Reports. And if you click on that, it will take you to a series of cyber books. I think they're numbered 1 to 7. And you can download it, and it is then yours. The book part is not terribly long, maybe 100 pages, but it includes the largest database of documents, letters, maps, reports, memos, you name it, relative to Rendlesham, than any book ever published. In fact, it's about 350 pages, including photos, and you can become your own authority on the case if you read the whole thing.
Right, right. And I have tried to get Nick Pope and Jim Peniston on this show to answer your charges in deception, and I have been summarily ignored. Mm. And I know the emails have not bounced back.
Yeah.
In fact, the first email to Nick Pope, he said, I'm under the weather right now. Get back with me. So I gave it a couple months, and I guess he's either still under the weather or on top of the weather or wherever he is, but he still has ignored me. I haven't even heard from Peniston. I say, his email did not bounce back, so it was the right one.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I'd be happy to discuss our differences with either of them or listen intently to any show that they did addressing the questions that I bring up.
Right, right. So, like I say, it's possible that you got information wrong. Come on, Nick Pope. Come on, Jim Peniston. And tell me where he got it wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm sure he'd like to know. I'm sure Mr. Robbins would like to know. So I certainly would. I think our listeners certainly would like to know where you got it wrong, where they got it wrong. We just want to know the truth.
Yep.
And that's what I'm all about, and that's what Peter Robbins is all about. And I think the listener is all about the truth, too. So let's get it done. So once again, this is Peter Robbins. I'm afraid we're running short on time, but where can people go to find out more about your work?
My website, peterrobbinsny.com, which is fairly new. Content will be added over the next months. My Facebook page, for sure.
Your Facebook page, which is, I don't know, I'm not on Facebook, so I don't know.
Any of your listeners that are, there are, not surprisingly, a number of people with my name. I'm the one noted in Ithaca, New York, where I live near.
Oh.
And you can contact me.
You're the good-looking guy, right?
Yeah, sometimes. Depends on the photo.
Whether or not you just got out of bed. I don't know. Okay. Peter Robbins, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And I hope we can do this again real soon.
I'll look forward to it, David.
Okay, my friend.
Be well, my friend.
You too. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all of the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage and Tuesday Forum, and then the date of the show that you want to listen to. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is UFOImplications.com. It's UFOImplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. And please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomena. So until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.